There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
A very good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap with me, Richard Dean. This evening, we're looking at how much you save on your retirement funds. We speak to the CEO of Majid Al Futtaim Properties about expansions in the retail market, and we talk to the principal of a Dubai school that was recently hit by a cyber attack. But first, let's look at the latest news out of India on the cash-strapped Jet Airways. Naresh Goyal, who's known as the promoter and chairman of Jet Airways, or at least he was this time yesterday, no longer. He has agreed to step down as chairman, also his wife stepping down as part of a bailout rescue package by banks in India. We'll give you the details in a second, but first of all, I was keen to know a little bit more about Naresh Goyal. Who is this guy who's been at the helm of Jet Airways for so long and whose reign is now over? This is he, speaking not yesterday, but a few years ago in happier times, about some of the challenges facing the Indian airline industry in general. And if you listen to his words, actually, some of what he was talking about, these are the very factors that have had Jet fall into such financial difficulties.
What we are doing, all of us, as you know,
yes.
I mean, we all want competition. I think everybody's selling below cost. No business can sustain if you continue selling below cost.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not saying the regulation.
Yes.
But I think some sort of a, some sense must prevail where no business can
sustain that beyond a point.
No
and business. Everybody is doing that, you're saying. Everyone is selling below cost.
Every airline in India is losing money without exception.
And that is why Reuters reports that Jet Airways is, to use their words, saddled with debt of more than $1 billion, has been on the brink of collapse, has had to ground more than two-thirds of its fleet as it struggled to pay lenders, suppliers, pilots and leasing companies. So banks, led by State Bank of India, have moved in to take a majority stake in the airline after Jet failed to convince potential investors, including, of course, its largest shareholder, Etihad Airways, to save the airline. Goyal's departure, says Reuters, could reignite investor interest in Jet Airways. Tata Sons, remember, late last year, had been in talks to invest in Jet. Their condition was that Naresh Goyal steps down. At the time, he was refusing to, but he's finally caved into those demands. He is gone. So that opens up potential investment from others. Let's hear now from one of the other key players in this story, Rajnish Kumar. Now, his job is chairman of the State Bank of India. It's the biggest single lender to Jet Airways, and it's leading the negotiations of a consortium banks owed money by Jet. He says, with the latest deal, that Jet can go forward. He also alludes to potential talks with Etihad.
IBC means that we are grounding the airline. So we will try. Till such time, we believe that all hope is lost. But as on date, I can say that not all hope is lost. So we have not reached that decision point where we say enough is enough and nothing can be done and let the airline be
grounded. What is government's direction to you?
Government's no direction. One thing you have to understand, I dislike this world. We are bankers. We know our commercial interest. It is our duty to keep the government informed. There is a one unanimous view that till such time all hope is not lost. Effort should be made to keep the airline running. And everybody believes that Jet Airways is a good aviation property.
Do you know what? I have two questions on the back of that. The most obvious one, where he says, no, all hope is not lost and we should do everything that we possibly can to keep the airline running until such time as we can't, is the reputation risk. Even if Jet Airways gets back to full strength, how long will it take before people trust it?
Good question.
My second is a little bit more practical to do with Etihad, because the chairman, Mr. Goyal, and his wife were not the only two people to step down yesterday. So did one of Etihad Airways' two nominees on the Jet Airways board. They have two people who sit on there on behalf of Etihad Airways. Now they only have one. What do we actually read into that? What does it tell us?
Well, I was speaking to some aviation experts in Abu Dhabi yesterday, not insiders at Etihad, but people who know the industry well. And they were saying that Etihad can kind of go one or two ways here. It's got a 24% stake. It can invest heavily and go in deeper and be part of the rescue, or it can try and cut its losses and get out. And one of the conditions in very complex negotiations, I was told yesterday, for Etihad investing any more money was that Naresh Goyal had to go, or at least take a much reduced role. That has happened. Now, that does not mean or guarantee that Etihad will invest more, but it does raise that possibility. Of course, the other possibility is that some of Etihad's shares are converted into equity, the bank into debt. The banks take control, and Etihad has some kind of diluted stake. We don't know yet. To get more on this, we've been speaking to Gaurang Shah. He's head of investment strategy at Geojet Financial Services in Mumbai. He follows this story closely. We asked him what's the latest and what happens next. This is what he told us.
As the board meet or the lenders meet concluded yesterday, by the time the market wind up and late evening, we got the confirmation that Mr. Naresh Goyal, his wife and any other family member have resigned from the board of Jet Airways with no active function at their end. 1,500 crores is what is being infused by the PSU bank, State Bank of India. Most likely possibility of these funds are the primary requirement to get the operations at the ground level taking off, paying off salaries of pilots, engineers and other ground personnel. And of course, get the aircrafts back into the flying mode from the lessors who have repossessed them. What remains to be seen is the timeline given, that is possibly by end of April, mid of May. That is when most possibly we'll have more clarity in terms of who's going to be the new owner of the ailing Jet Airways airline. But again, whether 1,500 crores is enough to keep the airline afloat, only time will tell.
Only time will tell. We know that Naresh Goyal's stake has been cut to give the banks a bigger stake in the organisation. That has been reported by Reuters, so we know that. But we don't know what has happened to the Etihad stake. That has not been reported. Naresh Goyal saying, no sacrifice is too big for me to safeguard the interests of Jet Airways and the families of the 22,000 employees. We're going to be watching this one closely in the coming days, weeks and months.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. A new survey out from Friends Provident, the insurance company. Brandy, you got the details?
I have. And I tell you what, it's some painful reading. They've done this research with YouGov. So a big proper research firm taking care of it, because obviously Friends Provident International are in the investment space. They are the sort of people who want to sell you the sort of schemes that would fix the problems pointed out by this survey. But YouGov is the people who have done the research. And what they have found is, in a nutshell, we all expect to retire quite early, quite well, but we don't expect to do much to get there.
That's about the sum of it. What was the metaphor? I was saying people want the moon when they retire.
And I said they weren't willing to build the rocket.
Whichever metaphor you choose, it's really quite scary.
It is. 34% of us want to retire by the age of 55. 53% of us expect to be retired at least by 60. But only 48% of us, so that's less than half, are saving towards it. And in fact, one third of us, so around 33%, are only putting up to 10% of the monthly income away. 58% of us, so nearly two-thirds, say that they're really only going to start saving in the last 10 years of their working life before retirement. Now, I don't want to get judgy about this, because I know that saving can be tough. A lot of people have lost jobs. A lot of people are not where they thought they would be in their careers at the moment for circumstances outside of their control, namely economic circumstances. So I wonder if a lot of these people aren't saying, I can't be bothered to save more than 10% of my income. Maybe people are saying, do you know what, 10% is pretty good going at the moment, considering what we're facing as a family. But the bigger point is that there is some worrying statistics here.
No, there are. 52% aren't having some kind of regular savings plan. And I figure that for about 20%, that's understandable. We've all been in periods of our life when, as you say, we weren't doing as well as we'd want. Most of us, I certainly have. And you making ends meet at the end of the month is the challenge. And sometimes we spend more in a month than we earn. And again, absolutely been there at times in my life. So if you're in one of those times in your life, don't feel guilty or bad that you're not saving. We don't want to make anyone feel bad about this. It happens. But if you're steady state, everything's going fine, you've got a decent salary, money's coming in, you're just living a bit beyond your means and not carving out enough. You're not, to use the phrase, paying yourself first by paying your savings account first of all. That's a worry. And I reckon maybe of the 52% who aren't saving regularly, let's put 20% in the category of, well, at the moment it's not the right time. But that leaves about 30% who probably could, but are choosing effectively not to. Maybe passively choosing. They haven't sat down and goes, I'm going to make a decision that I'm not going to save.
But you haven't done
anything. But their lifestyle choices mean that they're not. And that's a concern. We've been speaking to lots of people about this, including Rob. He says it's good to start thinking from an early age that you don't have to spend money.
Well, I've been in Dubai for a long time, so I'm established. So I save about 10% of my salary and I invest about another 50%. And that is just about the understanding that you're going to need to save for retirement and put stuff away in the good years for when you might not have the same earning potential later in life. I think I was fortunate in that I grew up in a house where there wasn't excess and there wasn't a thought process of excess. So I learned from a young age to not go out and have the latest shiny toy and so on and so forth, all that from a young age. So, no, both my wife and I are both frugal livers, if that's a term.
Rob, I think you should be giving courses and lessons. That sounds like the perfect way to live your life. The one caveat being that we all live in Dubai and benefit from the Dubai economy. If we're not spending at least a little bit in the Dubai economy and just squirreling everything away and sending it home, we're a little bit taking from the Dubai economy without giving back. But that's a small caveat. On the whole, Rob, I think what you're doing is great.
Are you saying going to brunch is some kind of civic duty because you're paying into the economy?
And any economy needs consumers. And we can't sit around complaining, oh, well, the economy's not doing very well, you know, retail sales are down, when we're not shopping. We want other people to be shopping because that fuels the economy. Of course we do. That's brilliant. But I'm not going to do it because I'm saving.
I'm not sure that my accountant explaining my shoe purchases, I'm just doing my bit for the economy. I'm doing my bit for the economy. Nationalistic. I don't think that's going to wash.
I'm not labouring the point. I'm just throwing it out there. Sony says his pension savings have taken a bit of a backseat lately. Here's why.
So I started off with something like a pension scheme. It took sort of a medium term. And then in between, realised that cost of education was going to be quite high. So topped that up after I had my first child, the same when I had my second. But honestly speaking, you know, apart from then putting aside something in case of emergency for life cover, there's not really much left over. I put a little bit towards property, which is about, say, anywhere from 5 to 8%, 22% within sort of regular saving, about 3% into life. And it's a good 35% when you consider it. But after expenses, there's not much left over.
Joy says it doesn't have to be massive amounts. Joy says small savings can go a long way.
I think I'm quite uncertain about the future. And I think I'm slightly more risk averse than most people. So I've just adopted the approach where I said I need to park away at least 50% of my annual income into savings.
That's Joy, 50% of annual income into savings. That's impressive, Joy.
It is. And I think, for the purposes of today, we're kind of using savings and investment interchangeably, aren't we? I'm having a drill down into this survey.
If you're saving and not investing, you're Brandy Scott.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Less than a third of us are actually entitled to a state pension in the countries that we come from. 52% of us, and that is Brandy Scott, I'm one of them, will not be entitled to a pension when they retire. There's different rules in different countries, and it is worth figuring out what they are, of which 16% of us, those in the middle, don't know what they are, because I know there's countries like the UK that you can live abroad, but you can still pay into making you eligible for the pension. Other countries, such as my own, that is not an option, and it is worth sitting down and figuring out which pool you fit into.
Malcolm Taylor, I know, gets a monthly stipend from the British government. He's on vacation, by the way. He's back on Sunday morning.
He is.
I might get a little bit, but not much. Essentially, my calculations are that I will get zero from the state. And if I do get anything, it's a Brucey bonus, but I'm certainly not relying on it.
If you live outside New Zealand, even if you only live next door in Australia, it is a big fat no from them, and you have to move back well before you retire and start paying in to be eligible. You can't just sort of come back at the end as well. So they want to make sure that you have contributed if you are going to be benefiting.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap.
And we are so excited to announce the return of our winning in business feature. And to kick it off, to welcome the CEO of Majid Al Futtaim Properties into the studio as our first guest, Ahmed Galal Ismail. It's so nice to have you in here again. How nice to see you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Looking at the challenges particularly facing retail at the moment, and we've spoken so much on the Business Breakfast and heard so much about more online spending, reduced physical retail spending, a soft retail market. What are you seeing on the ground?
Well, first of all, we're seeing three really mega trends that are shaping the entire retail ecosystem, both for shopping mall operators and for our retail partners. One, we're seeing the world has gone digital. In every aspect, and that's all around us. Second, we are seeing our customer getting younger and younger every day as more and more millennials start having sort of getting into the workforce, having more spending power, and as such, the average age of our customers getting younger. The combination of the world going digital and our customers getting younger means that customer expectations have changed tremendously over the past 3 to 5 years. People are more demanding, they're less compromising on the quality of service that they receive. They demand instant gratification, and their expectations are no longer shaped by the best mall or the best retail shop, but the best customer experience in whatever sector they deal with online.
So what do you, as a mall operator, do to try and tackle that?
Well, we think ourselves as a platform that connects people and our retail partners and allows them to really sort of create these fantastic moments. And in that context, what we are focusing on is first to increase our customer experience quotient. We believe in a world that's gone digital with younger customers, customer experience is paramount. And for us, it means that every single customer interaction has to be effortless, memorable, and sensorial. We are also investing significantly in upgrading and changing the mix of brands and retailers we have in our malls to provide better experience offer. You would see that in City Center Data that's about to celebrate its 25th anniversary. And you would see that we're completely re-merchandising the center, adding more F&B, adding more experiences, and less, I would say, classic retail offers.
As well as a mall operator, you are also a landlord. And we've spoken to a lot of retailers about needing more flexibility in their rents in a soft market. As a landlord, what are you doing at the moment to work with them?
Well, if you buy into the premise that we're not just a landlord, we are a platform that connects our retail partners with our customers, we have to take a very different posture in that relationship. And we think about it as a partnership that goes well beyond rent. It means that we collaborate more in terms of sharing data. And data is the fuel for growth for both retailers and for platform businesses like ourselves. We collaborate more on co-marketing, and we collaborate more on bringing new experiences. And that has to, of course, be in the context of a commercial framework that makes sense for both parties. I think in a market where obviously many of our partners are facing headwinds, it's important to recognize that premium platforms, premium destinations will always attract premium customers and will always demand premium rent. And part of the adjustment that we have to go through as well is to offer a platform for some of our smaller retail and F&B partners. So for instance, the new foothold that we're developing in City Center Deira, we at Majid Futtaim will be making the majority of the investment and will be offering really a platform for perhaps smaller, more ethnic, more local F&B operators to come in and out of the foothold at a relatively low cost of entry and a low cost of exit as well.
So lower prices for the newer, smaller, as you say, sort of local players. What about the big guys, though, that are struggling? Because you don't want an empty mall. You don't want coming soon hoardings around shops, do you?
Well, we're in a very lucky position, first of all, that you know our occupancy remains to be fairly strong in the high 90s. We've just announced our results for 2018. And you would have seen from our results that both our shopping mall business has done well. But interestingly, what has done even better within the Majid Futtaim ecosystem is that our retail businesses, whether it's Majid Futtaim Retail or Majid Futtaim Cinemas, have actually had a fantastic year with double-digit growth. So I think while the entire landscape may look sort of challenging. Within that, there are certainly premium destinations, premium locations that will always demand a premium, and perhaps a longer tail of locations that will continue to be challenged.
We interviewed the man behind an up-and-coming mall in Abu Dhabi yesterday, Reem Mall, which is still to open its doors, and is building a massive logistics centre in the basement with Agility, and that's going to be for e-commerce fulfillment, with very much the idea that if you can't beat them, join them. If people are going to be buying stuff online, they might as well buy online from your partners and fulfill it from the mall there. I mean, I know you've had a long-standing partnership with Fetcher to deliver things. How far can you go to being part of that e-commerce space?
Well, we've been on that journey for a couple of years now, and omnichannel enablement for our sister companies like Carrefour, Vox Cinemas, etc., as well as our retail partners, is top of our agenda. First, we have, as you rightly mentioned, we have partnered with Fetcher. We're now the second largest investor in the company to enable last mile delivery. We are investing in a lot of our data infrastructure and digital infrastructure to enable not just last mile fulfillment, but digitization of inventory, etc. And from the 25 shopping centers that we have in our portfolio, many of them are neighborhood and community centers where we have partnered with Carrefour today. And you see that Carrefour within the local catchment areas of our community and neighborhood malls are able now to commit to 60-minute delivery to our customers, which provides a new meaning to convenience. We're not just around the corner from you physically, but we are always 60 minutes away from you digitally as well.
Let's talk about Saudi Arabia. Last time we spoke to you, you were just about to open cinemas in Saudi Arabia. You have done so. What can you tell us about the take-up, occupancy rates? How do you measure the success or otherwise of a cinema?
Well, we're delighted that we continue to make quick entry into Saudi Arabia. We today command a 95% market share just with 40 screens. I think we've opened 40 screens and the entire market has just opened one. So this goes to show how fast and how prepared we were for the opportunity. The uptake has been fantastic. Saudis love our brand of entertainment and cinematic experience. And we're very excited about the Vox Cinema's entry in Saudi Arabia because it's also validation of our wider Saudi investment plan. We have a multi-billion dollar investment plan in Saudi Arabia that doesn't just include Vox Cinemas and our retail businesses, but is also anchored by two significant size shopping centers, Mall of Saudi, which we believe will be a game changer for the retail landscape in Saudi Arabia. And for the first time, we'll be able to bring what we believe is a truly experiential destination to a market that is fast changing and I would say now very much ready for that type of offer.
When you're building a mall from scratch, you get to do stuff that maybe you wish you'd done in your older malls without having to retrofit. What will you be doing in these brand new malls that you've learned from previous experience?
And one of our biggest learnings is really flexibility and agility. And this means that we invest more upfront in infrastructure and we invest more upfront in the design and the layout of the shopping center to make sure that the center would live for 100 years and will continue to evolve as customer needs evolve. So it's in this day and age, a younger customer, changing trends, everything has to be Instagrammable, etc. You need to make sure that your physical spaces are as open, as flexible as possible to continue to change and evolve.
Ahmed Galal Ismail, thank you so much for joining us. The CEO of Majid Al Futtaim Properties, lovely to have you.
Thank you very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
Our next guest is in to talk about something that a lot of people don't even admit to, and that is a cyber attack. The Dubai British School was hit by a cyber attack this month, and we are joined now by the school principal, Brendan Fulton. Brendan, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
It's an absolute pleasure. Good to be here.
Do you want to tell us what happened?
Sure. So it was a fairly scattergun approach to, rather than a cyber attack. We had a whole host of emails going out, phishing emails purporting to be staff members from the school or people associated with the school, requesting various bits of information, but generally asking people to click on a link to access something. Fairly standard phishing attack. Unfortunately, one or two staff members or parents did click on this link, and that again then provides further access into the network, which exacerbated the problem.
Did the people targeting you get anything?
No, fortunately, they weren't able to access any of the school's data, which is obviously very important. Our data is very well protected. And in fact, phishing attacks such as this need to go through several very important layers before they can access sensitive data, because it generally relies on people to provide that data for them. Fortunately, most people realized what it was, alerted us, and that's when we sent out the information to the community and to the parents.
And the parents were targeted as well. I mean, I understand there were fake emails asking them to do things like open up a PDF that was about a possible rebate.
Yeah, again, a very standard approach. Provide something that looks fairly tantalizing, hope that people click on it. But again, it would have required parents to provide further information so that they could dig deeper into our security.
But they obviously got the parents' email addresses from somewhere. So does that suggest a level of compromise?
Yeah, that's the first layer basically, once somebody clicks on the link, they're able to access the address book of the person that clicked on the link. So any parent emails that had been in the address book could have been compromised.
So what did you do? You learnt about the attack when?
We learnt about the attack last week. The minute we learnt about it, we got in the security experts that work with Talim that help protect our schools. And they immediately protected our network against any further compromises. And we then sent out information to the school's community. As a learning institution ourselves, we use these opportunities to teach not just the children, but the families, the staff, everyone involved in the school community, exactly what these attacks look like and how to protect yourself from them moving forwards.
One of the things I think that surprised me the most about this isn't the fact that you were targeted, because we know that these kind of attacks are only on the rise. It's the fact that you've come out so quickly and told everyone about it.
Yeah, I think that is fairly unique. But again, as a learning community, we don't pretend that these things don't happen. What we do is we use it as an opportunity to learn from it. We were fortunate that there was no serious compromise associated with this one. So for us, it was a low-risk opportunity for us to be able to teach people what these cyber attacks look like, what phishing emails are all about, and to provide an opportunity for the whole school community to learn from it and to further protect themselves, not just in terms of their association with the school, but just generally.
Has it changed the way that you think about your cybersecurity?
Not really. Our cybersecurity was strong enough to ensure that there wasn't further insults to the system. But it has, I think, re-energized our thoughts in terms of how we are proactive against these sorts of things. And again, not necessarily in terms of physical infrastructure, but in terms of how we communicate with our community about being aware of such things. I think the clever aspect behind this phishing attack, because most of it was fairly rudimentary, was the fact that they relied on the fact that families would normally trust information and emails that came from their son or daughter's school.
And also, it managed to target exactly what people do care about. I mean, this isn't some kind of complete... I mean, I know it's a password spraying technique, so it is fairly scattergun. But the fact that they've sent out emails purporting to be from a school saying, if you're interested in a possible rebate, click on this. I mean, that just totally taps into where everyone is at the moment.
I'm clicking every time on that.
Yeah, it's almost worth the risk. I think this is, again, a standard. It's not just with regards to phishing emails. It's a standard thing on social media at the moment. It's known as clickbait, where a tantalizing headline of some sort, ostensibly purporting to be something else, promotes clicks. And this is really the gist of a phishing email. There needs to be something in there that people are prepared to look past the rudimentary nature of the message or the weirdness behind it and actually have a look.
But it suggests also that there are real humans thinking about you, targeting you, knowing what you do, knowing what the economic environment in Dubai is like.
Yeah, 100%. And like I said, knowing that parents are likely to trust correspondence that comes from their son or daughter's school.
Before we let you go, Brendan, what advice would you share with other schools and, in fact, organizations in general?
I think especially for schools, but all organizations, transparency is absolutely key. Being transparent with your community reinforces that idea of the trust that they can have. I think people should know that their data is being protected, and all organizations that do business with individuals have sensitive data and sensitive information about them. So transparency is key, but also to continue to be vigilant. The whole point of cyber attacks is they learn how to get past the latest security measures. So make sure that your security measures are constantly reviewed, kept up to date, and that your whole community is aware of what you are doing to protect them.
Brendan Fulton, who is the principal at Dubai British School, hit by a phishing attack this month. Thank you very much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
That's it for the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. live with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.